This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Though downtown Charlotte has 8 theaters inside the 277 loop, entertainment has begun to spill out onto the streets. And you're going to find out about a group of young people you may have heard as you spilled out of a downtown theater and onto the street. The Brass Connection plays outdoors downtown almost every night, and we meet them and hear their story later in the program. First, though, we continue what has turned out to be an unintentional Shakespeare summer series. Earlier, Tina Packer, founder of Shakespeare & Company, joined us to talk about the Bard. Then writer A.J. Hartley talked about writing and producing Macbeth, the novel, an audiobook with Alan Cummings. And today, we take a closer look at what could arguably be considered William Shakespeare's most challenging play, King Lear. Longtime and unfortunately former Charlotte actor Graham Smith has returned to play the title role in the collaborative arts production that opens next Wednesday at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater, and he joins us now. You've been on this program before, so welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. Also with us is Elise Wilkinson, Executive Director and Artistic Director of Collaborative Arts, which finds the strangest places to do their shows sometimes, although the McGlowan is not one of them. Welcome back to the program as well.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And in an unusual move, twist my arm, Tim Ross, one of our producers, goes from behind the scenes to front and center because he is directing this production of King Lear and, I believe, is playing the role of Edmund. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, aren't you?
I wasn't asked to direct Charlotte Squawk, so I had to find a job somewhere.
Consider yourselves fortunate. Graham, it's been a long time since you were here, and people who go back a ways and who attend theater would recognize you as being one of the key actors involved in Charlotte Rep in its 27-year history? Is that 24, 25, 26, somewhere in there.
All right. 25.
But you're from here, right? Is that correct?
I grew up in Davidson.
In Davidson?
Yeah. My dad worked at Davidson College as the director of the union. C. Shaw Smith, if any Davidson grads are listening. And went to North Mecklenburg and all that and went to Davidson College and got an English degree. And then came and met Steve Umberger and started doing stuff.
Steve Umberger was the longtime artistic director of Charlotte Repertory
Theater. I also studied with Connie Welsh, I've got to say, as a kid growing up. And I used to go over to her house every Saturday from when I was maybe 7 until I was probably 15 or so. And we did creative dramatic workshops.
Yeah, she was the progenitor of Teradiddle Players, wasn't she?
She was the source of most of the theater in this town.
Yeah. She was everybody's drama mother. People used to go over to her house and watch the Oscars, and she would change her outfit every 15 minutes and come down and walk down the stairs. It really was a wonderful tradition. She was a grand, grand lady. And going there every Saturday, I had sort of a love-hate relationship with drama even then. I used to describe it as, it was sort of like getting in the bathtub. You don't want to get in, but once you get in, you don't want to get out.
Explain that to people, because people assume that people who make their living, which you do, on a stage, love to be up on that stage, would die if they couldn't get up on that stage. But it's a love-hate relationship. You don't want to get up there, but when you're up there, you love it. Why?
I think it's because, well, for me, the more I do it, in a way, the harder it gets, because you keep raising the bar for yourself, and you try to simplify your work and get truer with it, you realize that your own BS or your own rhetoric about your work is what's standing in the way, and I don't know, you just get harder on yourself about what is true. So it's there's a greater onus to continue to grow and be truer in your work. And it's, you know, it used to be great just to be in a play, and that was fun.
Right.
But now there's a different, I don't know, I look for something.
Yeah, there are expectations placed on you. You have to be able to top your previous performance or at least equal it.
Well, I don't even know what that means.
Right.
I can't.
But the audience.
I can't
does.
Compare. Well, maybe so, but, you know, I can't address those things. I can only address the things that are, that I feel sort of intuitively in myself. And I have to push myself harder to get to a truer place. Well, in some ways it gets simpler too, but it's...
But it's also live. Live theater brings a whole set of dread and danger and excitement and stimulation. And for me, that's the love-hate. It's anything can happen, and there's always a danger
in that. And usually it does.
Yes, but there's always a joy in that because it's live.
Which is what would freak me out about Shakespeare, because it's one thing to do the play that we were talking about before the show started, The Foreigner.
Yeah.
Anything can happen, and it does. And in the, something happens in The Foreigner, you can ad-lib around it. But in Shakespeare...
Mike, you're scaring me.
I have seen actors ad-lib Shakespeare. I've actually seen it done.
I am a pentameter.
You just keep doing ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum.
That's right.
You mumble in that rhythm. Although I did a play one time. I did Lear one time. I played The Fool with Earl Hyman. And he went up on a line. And the line as written is, "I am cut to the brains." Oh, my wife just told me I have to work on this. I'm cut to the brain.
Ah.
And he unfortunately started with, "My brains are cut to the..." But he had built sort of a harumph in his performance, and so he said, "Oh. My brains are cut to the..." So, when in doubt, add one of those.
Well, at least Lear can do that because he is on the brink of insanity.
I think that's the am and the I am.
I believe that's
yeah,
am.
Exactly. So that's my plan. That's my safety net.
So you have gone off. You and your wife is Audrey.
I have gone off indeed.
Well, your wife is Audrey Brown, who was an equity stage manager in this town for a long time, and now obviously works in Florida and in Philadelphia and other places around the country, because you can't work here if you're in that position, because there's no resident company that's an equity company here. But you have gone off to Philadelphia,
yeah,
and you work with a company called People's Light and Theater in Philadelphia. What are they like? What's that company like?
Well, it's one of the few actually resident companies in that it has a core of actors that are continuous there. So I'm a company member. That model is not followed very much in America anymore, and I like it. It was always my intention, even as a young actor, I wanted to be in a company rather than, you know, try to make it in New York or on Broadway. That kind of stuff.
I think that gives the audience who goes to that theater, I would think, a lot of pleasure, because they see the same actors doing completely different things.
And we hope it's pleasure. Yeah. You know, it puts you in the position of having a conversation, a continuing conversation with the audience, because they see you as an actor working on your craft. So they see what you're doing in context of all these other performances. So the elements of the craft that are different show to show are part of that interchange between the audience and the actors. And I think that's more interesting, hopefully, to a subscribing audience than, you know, selecting the one actor that might fit this role who either is employing craft or actually is that guy, you know.
Right.
So I think that interchange is boring.
You, if you go to their website, People's Light and Theater in Philadelphia, there will be a photograph of Graham Smith as King Lear carrying Cordelia. I assume that's who you're carrying. Could have been somebody from the audience. Who knows? But is this the fourth time you've been in the show and the third time that you've played Lear? Is that correct?
That's right.
What keeps you coming back to what has to be an incredibly difficult role to play?
Well, it certainly is difficult. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm interested in it. I know that there's no way to do it correctly, or there's no way to do it... there's no definitive way to do it. So that challenge is exciting, and also the fact that it sort of provides a safety net, because I don't have to ever go, that's it, I've done it. It's something I just have to jump into and give everything that I have to it and let the chips fall where they may.
Has it changed over the years for you, the way you play it, the way you see it, the way you understand it?
Well, what's changed is my attention has gone on to other things. I think the first time I did it, I was making sure that I was sort of justifying being the guy who was doing it. And I was working on the size of my instrument and on the size of my being to make sure that it was commensurate with the job. Not that I think that I've earned that in my own head, but I've gone on to something else. And I'm a lot more interested in embracing the ambiguities of it and letting it be a little sloppier and a little more erratic and letting it, you know, fall as it does. putting myself in a position where I'm sort of caught and just having to respond without managing it so well. I mean, that's always the process in working on a role. But right. in a role like this, I think the reason I keep coming back to it is because it's the hardest thing I've ever done. And that's interesting to me. I also have a personal goal is I want to perform it 100 times. Because somebody said to me a long time ago, once you perform something 100 times, then you have an understanding of what it is. So after I get 100 in, I will decide whether I should have been doing it or not.
There's a scary thought.
This production, yeah. This production will take me up to 54, I think. So.
Graham mentioned that there's no way, there's no one way to do this. There's no right way or wrong way, I would think, to do this.
Well, there are probably lots of wrong ways.
Well, I think you'll certainly know it if you see it.
Yeah, see it. Who knows?
But we've talked about this earlier this year with the two other guests that we talked about.
Tina Packer.
Yeah. That Shakespeare lends itself to interpretation. You can put it anywhere, anytime, in any costuming, and it seems to work. What are you doing with this, Tim?
This is a very spare production because we wanted to focus on just the storytelling, the text, what he is saying in this show. So the set elements are very simple. There's really only one set piece, and I don't want to say too much about it, but that set piece will set up the power and authority that Lear has and then the disintegration of that power and authority all the way through the play. And we felt like putting ourselves on a stage without a lot of stuff around us would make it harder and clearer for us to simply tell the story. And the relationships that we have with each other. There's a lot of conspiracy in the play. There are a lot of thread lines that run, a lot of family relationships. And so the clearer we can be with each other on stage, we felt the better the story would be told. And so we don't back it up with a lot of set elements.
I think that sparseness really fits the Spirit Square stage as well.
Right.
It's a beautiful stage.
It's perfect for Lear. Yeah, it's the height of it.
I've talked about this with opera singers who make a living. They'll find a niche in a part, and they'll go from opera company to opera company to opera company, playing Othello, for instance. Yeah. And I always wonder, once you've done the role for the Met, or you've done it for La Scala, or you've done it for whoever, Is there a tendency to say, well, when we did it at the Met, here's how we did it. I mean, is there a lot of that going through your mind? I want
to
preserve the best of what
phrase.
I did before.
I avoid that phrase. But, I mean, the things that you know about the bones of it are pretty much in, I think they're in there. And that gives you a leg up on whatever happens next. But what you're really paying attention to, ultimately, is the energy of exactly the specific energy of the people you're playing opposite. Mm-hmm. The bones of it might change some, but how the lines function and how they demand, how one line demands the next line, that kind of stuff, those things are really, they're just sort of in there.
And when you're working against somebody new in a role when you've done this role before.
Working against?
Working with somebody in a scene.
Might feel like that in this play.
You know what I'm saying. When there's somebody new on the other side of the stage.
Yeah.
Playing the role of Edmund, for instance. How do you change your performance? And I only have 15 seconds. Or do you have to change your performance?
Well, it changes immediately. I mean, I don't carry a memory of a past memory around like that because you're playing the specific energy and the breath that comes out of your scene partner. So that's immediate and right there.
We're talking about King Lear, which opens next week, and I'll bring Elise Wilkins into this conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE listeners and Creative Loafing. Creative Loafing's Best of Charlotte issue hits the streets August 17th, available in print and online at clclt.com. Well, for centuries, school was about reading, writing, and arithmetic. But today, under No Child Left Behind, it seems to be about reading and arithmetic. But not about things like social studies, which include history. Aren't those subjects just as important, particularly in a democracy? What's the future of an America ignorant of its own history and how the government works? Well, we're going to talk about that and about the social and political impact of a lack of social studies in the schools Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Pretty News Roundup, you'll hear top journalists give meaning to the week's national headlines. Take a look back at what happened, how it affects your world. The Friday News Roundup. Join us.
Stay tuned for the Diane Rehm Show coming up next from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source for 30 years.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. King Lear opens at McGlohan Theater next, Wednesday, August the 3rd, the day after we go into default.
Great.
But it's free.
That's right.
Saved by the bell.
The good news for you is it's free, so if the money's worthless, it doesn't matter. Graham Smith is with us. He's the lead actor. He plays King Lear, a longtime Charlotte actor who has gone on to work elsewhere around the country because there's no place to work here anymore. Elise Wilkinson is executive and artistic director of Collaborative Arts, and Tim Ross is director of King Lear. Elise, this play is supposed to be among the most challenging in the Shakespeare canon, and I guess that makes it among the most challenging plays out there in the English-speaking theater. Why, then, do you want to do this play?
That's a good question, right? So, the Charlotte Shakespeare Festival, which is the umbrella under which we produce these plays every summer. So we're in our sixth year now, and there's a lot of thought that goes into every season. What are the plays that we're going to choose, and what is the journey over a given time period that we're going to take our audiences on? So when we started the festival 6 years ago, the logical way to start it was with A Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. Very accessible. Everybody mm-hmm. knows it. We could pull an audience out. It was an easy introduction because there was no Shakespeare in Charlotte at the time. And so as an artistic director, one of the things I think about is, what are we doing next year? How are we going to challenge or push our audience, but how are we going to do it in a way that we don't push them away, but we keep them excited and we keep stretching them? And so these big, meaty tragedies are part of that stretch. And so last summer we did Othello, which mm-hmm. for us was a risk. We had such wonderful feedback. And that went so well that it encouraged me that, okay, Charlotte is ready for this. We can do a big tragedy. King Lear, obviously, we would never approach unless you have a Lear. So we had discussions early in the year with a couple of actors, one of whom was Graham, about, are you available? Is this something you want to do? This may be a different environment that you've worked in before, but is this a project you can commit to? And when we found Graham, and Graham said, I want to do this, and it felt right that to get a professional actor back in his hometown felt like the right thing to do, that we need to give those opportunities to local actors, and we also need to stretch our audience. So it's not beyond what anyone can sit through or understand, but is it a little bit more difficult, perhaps, than the play you saw last summer or the summer before? Yes. But I think that's a good thing, and that's exciting to me.
You usually do a comedy and a tragedy. Last year you did, as you said, Othello, but also you did Comedy of Errors.
That's
this
right.
year you opened with Molière's Tartuffe.
That's right.
Which is a light, frothy thing, and then you end it with this. I'm detecting a pattern here. Why?
Oh, it's not something we have to do, and we may not do that every summer, but our audience, the feedback we get from our audience is that they do like that diversity. People do like to laugh. They do like to escape. They like to have fun, but they also like to have that environment where they're really challenged to think about issues. They really feel strong emotions. They come away wanting to discuss things with their friends, with their family members. So having that combination rolled into one summer is something that's worked well for us in the past.
Who have you found your audience to be for all these Shakespeare shows?
Mike,
and classic theater
shows. One of the things that excites me so much, and the reason that we keep doing this, and the reason that we are trying to keep it free, is that we have such a diverse audience. It's fascinating. I go to see a lot of theater in this town, a lot of arts, and I've never seen such a diverse audience. We get everything from families with children that they are using this as an experience to introduce them to the classics.
Mm-hmm.
We get busloads of retirees that come from retirement centers. We have groups of teenagers that come. We have corporate types that come. You can come on a date night. We really run the gamut in terms of our audience, and I think that's spectacular.
You do the comedies outdoors on the green,
yes,
which is down by the Radcliffe and down by the Mint Museum and the Beckler, et cetera. you do the tragedies indoors, and this time it's at the McGlowan. How do you keep all this free? The McGlowan isn't free.
We haven't always done tragedies here, so that's not necessarily givens. For instance, we did Much Ado About Nothing a few years ago in the McGlowan. The second show right now is in the Blumenthal. This is our fourth year here, and they have been wonderfully, the Blumenthal has been very supportive of our endeavors to keep this free. But really, practically speaking, the second show is indoors because it's August and it's Charlotte and it's really hot out there.
Good decision.
I don't think anyone hasn't noticed
that. How do you keep it free? Obviously, there are no royalties. You're not paying William Shakespeare anything for these plays, but how do you keep it free? I mean, you have actors and you have technicians and you have sets and lights.
We do. Honestly, with a lot of difficulty. This has been the most challenging year for us. We don't, philosophically speaking, from a management perspective, we don't run a deficit, which is a little unusual for an arts group. So every year we've done really well in terms of balancing our budget, and that's a way we'd like to keep it. This year, I'll be honest with you, we haven't balanced our budget. We have about an $8,000 deficit that we have to figure out how to close that gap before the end of the summer, and I don't know how we're going to do it. I think
that our passion.
Well, tis the season also. I mean, it is hard times, but one of the things that's important to us is to continue to grow artistically. So we continue to move the needle in terms of how many actors get Graham's up. So we've got Graham and Stephen Ware, who are equity actors that are in this production. And it's important for us to raise those values. So we depend a lot on audience donations at the shows. We ask everybody for a minimum $5 per person donation. And to be honest, if everybody that came to the show just gave $5, we would close that funding gap.
Wow.
It's that easy. And there are obviously other organizations that support us through grants and corporate sponsorships.
King Lear is regarded by many as Shakespeare's supreme accomplishment. Let me ask all three of you, why is that so?
I'm guessing because there's no category to put it in, no neat category. I think he's going sort of in a way beyond the tragic form. The other tragedies are a bit more classic. Mm-hmm. And there's a mature voice in there that's putting all the complications he can possibly put in it. And as soon as he puts one thing in it that you go, okay, that's kind of what it is, he layers it with something else. It's just a series of paradoxes in each character and almost in each moment. And that level of interlacing is, I think, more complex than any of the others. And he's also managed to do it with very little introspection on the part of any of the characters. They're all in action. And that's a supreme achievement.
Hmm. Is that what makes it so challenging?
To direct, absolutely, because it's a play about, if not everything, many, many things. Every relationship. Mm-hmm. We worked for an hour the other night in rehearsal on the relationship between two of the attendants standing behind the major characters who were in the most intense scene in the show. And they have a story to tell, a very important story in that scene. Every character, every line has some meaning, and it pushes the story, the many stories, forward.
And there are also a lot of things, I think, that aren't said in this play. So there are a lot of storylines where things happen off stage, where you have to, as an actor, you have to make sure you're coming in with the knowledge that some very important things have happened that no one has actually spoken of. And so you have to make sure that the storyline continues to move forward in a clear fashion. But there are all these things going on that aren't there in the text, as well as a heck of a lot that is in the text.
And I would say that's another departure from more classic Shakespeare works, because he is known for putting everything you need to know on the page. But in this, Edmund, for example, my character has very intricate and interesting relationships with two of the women in the play, but it's almost never spoken of. It just, you find.
Actually, I've never seen King Lear, so I read a synopsis of it yesterday, and it surprised that moment surprised me. I thought, where did that come from?
So did I. When I first started trying to put it together,
because when you read a synopsis of this, you barely can keep up with it.
Yeah.
It's like it's frantic. It's breathtakingly frantic to me in terms of the relationships and how things.
Oh, that's true. But it doesn't have a lot like a lot of the other Shakespeare's. It's got a lot of history in it, and this one is actually both. And I think this is part of why it's so great. It is epic and almost fairy tale in its simplicity. It's an easy story to follow, actually, visually, and when you watch it, because it's essentially parallel stories as well. But it's so clearly family dynamics straight through.
Well, let's just test this theory that you have then, Graham.
Uh-oh.
What's this play about? Give us a thumbnail. Go ahead.
Oh,
what's
well,
the plot?
It defies description.
That's right.
As we already decided, Mike.
Thank you.
I was prepared. But it is, I mean, you know, all the great plays are about family, and this one is really about family.
Boy,
but
is it.
But it's sort of fairy tale and epic, and yet has tiny little domestic details in it, too. So it's both small and huge at the same time.
Dallas is coming back on television in an updated version, and it's like Dallas. It's where J.R. gives over the empire to his rival siblings.
We were going to do the Dallas version, but we couldn't get enough cowboy hats.
These illusions are lost on me, Mike.
Yeah, you don't watch television.
Well, you know, at the risk of oversimplifying it, which I don't want to do to this play, but A.J. Hartley came the other night to sit in and just give his thoughts about Shakespeare.
He's the guy that wrote Macbeth the novel.
Right. Mm-hmm. At the end of the night, he said, well, you know, it's just a play about terrible fathers. It's much more than that. But Shakespeare can always be distilled down to very basic, very raw, very primal human relationships and human emotions.
Right. I think that's why we still are interested in Shakespeare after hundreds of years.
Right.
Still, it's relevant because it's that simple.
I was going to ask. I can't think of another playwright who is as relevant as Shakespeare after 400 years. What is it that in his writing, in his plays, in his themes, in the subject matter, in the characters he's created that makes him speak to 21st century audiences? And he does. What is it?
He wrote the truth.
A lot of playwrights have, haven't they?
Mm,
will we be doing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof in 400 years?
I hope so. It's a wonderful show.
I don't know.
All right.
But he just, because he distills it down to the most basic. You know, Graham and I are talking about someday doing this totally modern, completely modern. Everybody's in suits. Everybody has briefcases. It's still about power and authority and how it influences people, how it impacts families, how it can disintegrate what should be the truth of somebody's existence about love and familial relationships, and it's just basic themes.
So he's writing about human nature, which has not changed in 400
years. Yeah, you know, I think maybe some of the other playwrights have described the truth or something, and he's actually written it. I'm not quite sure what that means, but that's my story.
David on Facebook asks, do your guests have a favorite Lear? I recently saw Brian Blessed's version, and it was, I thought, brilliant, as was Gielgud, Olivier, and Brooke. Anybody have a favorite?
Graham Smith.
Well, there you go. That's
I'm a little biased.
A safe and a good answer, I think. I know you've, Tim, have done a lot of Shakespeare because you were in the previous Shakespeare company here in Charlotte in the 80s.
Some time ago, yes.
Yeah,
thank you.
When you were five, you were playing the kid roles, the ingenues. Most recently, but you've done you've done a lot of acting in Shakespeare. You've most recently directed
Glass Menagerie.
Glass Menagerie at Theatre Charlotte. Is this your first crack at directing Shakespeare?
It is.
And what a way to get your feet wet.
You're telling me. Yeah, but I've really tried to keep it simple from the directing point of view, which is to try to let the actor, especially when you have somebody who knows the play so well, is to the assistant director, who I'd like to name, Robbie Lefty, who's a great help. You know, we were talking about this, and it's more about editing what you already see on stage as opposed to trying to create something from scratch. You let the actors work out the relationships, and then you nudge them in certain directions. But you just have to stay with the text. You just have to respect the text always.
Well, now, you know, Glass Menagerie is an American classic play, and you did a little twist on it by casting it as an African-American version of that classic play. How is the approach that you would take to directing a classic American play different from directing this?
I have found some parallels in directing these two shows, but where we were exploring different twists with Glass Menagerie, I'm exploring taking all of that away in this and just focusing on the story with as little embellishment as possible. That's why the set vision and the overall sort of theme of the show visually is pretty simple, because I just felt like if you stay with the script and you work on every moment, every specific moment, then the story will be told in the proper fashion. And when you're given a certain amount of time to do a play like this, you have to focus your priorities. Yeah. And the priority is telling that specific story from moment to moment to moment.
Elise Wilkinson, I said at the very beginning that you've done your plays in some very strange places, because I know that you did one in an apartment. Literally in a condominium, in the living room of
a
condominium.
We've done two.
Great show.
Which I thought was a brilliant idea, and it was thoroughly enjoyable, because it was just being in that atmosphere right up next to the actor doing the part. It was like, wow, I'm literally in her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the mission of collaborative arts, how you do what you do and why you do it, and why you do the plays that you do.
Well, we're looking for great playwrights. So everything we do is centered around really good writing. But more importantly than that, the name collaborative is an important part of our mission, and that is we're looking to see what is not represented in the cultural landscape in Charlotte. So we started the Shakespeare Festival, for instance, because at the time there was nothing being done classically speaking. Mm-hmm. And the reason we continue to push our programming, so we did Molière for the first time, we'll continue to look at other classic playwrights too. On the contemporary side, we take a look around. You know, there's a lot of really great edgy theater happening in town, for instance, kind of the off Broadway stuff. That's not what we're going to do, because it's well represented in Charlotte. So the show we're doing in the fall, which is they're actually going to be the regional premiere of Time Stands Still by Donald Margulies that just finished on Broadway, not represented. There hasn't been a Margulies play in years here. So great playwright, something we can do well, do in an intimate setting. So we're looking for ways to complement what's going on in town and to provide new opportunities for people to see live theater.
I once told Graham Smith that he was my hero as an actor, because he is. We've had a lot of wonderful actors on this program over the years, and you are right there with them, period. There's no modification to that. You just are. And back in the day when Charlotte Rupp was here, we had a stable of actors, professional actors who were here, most of whom have gone away because they have to find work elsewhere because we don't have it here. What should we be, as a city, should we be concerned about that, and what does that say about us?
I can't say that the city should be concerned. I mean, the city either is or isn't. I'm disappointed that it doesn't seem to support or need art in the way that I think I need it.
Yeah,
I think
you grew
that's
up
probably
here.
I grew up here, yeah. And but, you know, on one level, I'm grateful that we were able to get the plays done that we got to get done early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm disappointed that Elise and Joe don't get more ready support, or the system of Charlotte doesn't have, I think, art as a necessary ingredient. It has it as a sort of a token part of the landscape.
Right.
I think it's an actual need, but, you know, that's where we are. And the grass is greener right now for me, usually, except for this event and other places.
Graham Smith, who plays King Lear in the collaborative arts production, which opens August the 3rd and runs through the 14th at the McGlone Theater at Spirit Square. It's free, no reservations required, but you can get information at their website. Elise Wilkinson, executive and artistic director, and Tim Ross, the director of the show. Thanks all for being here. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick BMW in Charlotte and Hendrick Motors in Hickory. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. 10 o'clock on the horizon, the Diane Rehm Show coming up at that time, and the weekly news roundup on tap for the first hour. The national news with Susan Page in for Diane, and a panel of journalists join Susan to talk about things like congressional lawmakers proposing competing debt plans to avoid a first ever default on U.S. obligations, and where all that stands before next Tuesday. The debt ceiling stalemate threatens to stall an already struggling U.S. economy, as everybody knows. And they'll also talk about GOP presidential candidate Rick Perry's rise to second in a new Gallup poll, among other topics. And you can be part of that conversation as well. Coming up, we hear from a bunch of street musicians that you may have heard as you passed through the square, or you came out of the Belk Theater one night and wondered, who are these people and why are they here? But boy, are they fun. That in a moment.
You can connect with WFAE on Facebook. Get news and programming updates, interact with other public radio listeners, receive invitations to special events around our region, and more. Just log on to Facebook, search for WFAE, and click the like button.
If you attend the Broadway series of musicals at the Belkin Knight Theaters downtown or have passed through the square one evening, you're familiar with that sound. If you don't attend and haven't visited downtown Charlotte in recent years, you may be unaware of this phenomenon. Street music is more common to New Orleans than to the Queen City, but the Brass Connection is doing its part to introduce the concept, and as theatergoers know, they are certainly enhancing the nightlife here. After every show, in the heat of summer and the dead of winter, the Brass Connection, nine musicians aged 6 to 46, can be found on Tryon Street near the entrance to the Performing Arts Center, playing for the post-show crowd, extending their entertainment experience for as long as they choose to listen. You can thank Bill Jones for that. You're the guy behind the drums. You must be the leader of the band.
Well, the manager. Yes, I am the manager of the band.
What does that mean to be the manager of this group of young people?
Just to take care of them, make sure everything is right with them.
But you're the father of a lot of these guys.
Yeah, I am father and grandfather, godfather. So, yeah, I take care of a lot of them.
You've been playing music, I would imagine, for a long time. How long?
9 years old. I was 9 years old, so that's like 42 years.
How did it start that you play on the streets here in Charlotte, not just after these shows that are at the Belk Theater in the night, but also at the Square and other places around town? How did it start?
We first started off just coming out here, just, you know, enjoying playing and making little tips. And then, you know, it just escalated from there because people started enjoying us. And we had older guys then, and the younger side guy was just carrying the instruments, and they started inquiring. I wanted to learn how to play, so... They started picking it up. Whoa, I say. Some of the older guys that faded off, they just took their place.
This one little fellow here named Michael, who is how old?
6.
He's been playing for how long?
About 8 months now.
And he plays trombone?
Yes.
And you specially made the trombone for him?
Yes.
Why?
Special trombone. Slap a little too long for him, so we got a little trombone we made for him, and he enjoys it, so.
Now, is this something he wanted to do because his older brothers were doing it?
Probably so, but he's a character. He really liked to get out there and do what he can do. Whatever he can play, he want to play.
Michael, you're 6 years old and you play trombone, is that right?
Yes.
And why did you want to start playing trombone? Why the trombone? Why not trumpet? Why not drums? Why not something else?
I like playing the horn because they taught me.
Well, yeah. You have a favorite song that you play every night?
Leave Me Alone.
Leave Me Alone? Is that the Leave Me Alone? Don't you? Hum it for me.
Huh?
Sing it for me.
Leave me alone. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. Leave me alone.
Whose song is that?
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. These guys are performers. They're not just musicians. They know how to put on a show. Where does that come from, Daddy?
Well, I was with, you know, Motown for a while, and I know what it takes, you know, to entertain. So people want to be entertained as well as, you know, hear the music and stuff. So they don't just want to see, they want to see some entertainment too. So we just incorporate all of it together.
So were you a session musician at Motown?
No, I was just producing. do some writing and stuff like that.
So you've been around the block. You know what you're doing here.
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah, I do. I do know what I'm doing. I ain't gonna do that.
So after working with all those Motown people, what's it like to work with family?
It's hard because, you know, they sometimes take you for a little granted, and I try to explain to them, you know, the ins and outs of things. You know, try to teach them more responsibility or what you can do, you know, and then definitely keeps them off the street. You know, they say I'm a little hard, but, you know, they, you know, hey, listen, you got to one thing or another, so.
Well, it keeps them off the street, but it keeps them on the street, but at least you're on the street with them.
With them, yeah, exactly, yeah.
The songs that you play are old Motown songs, old R&B songs, much older than these kids are. Do they enjoy it?
Yeah, you know, we put a little twist on it, you know, but, you know, the older songs is like real music, horns. We can relate to that better than a lot of, I guess, hip-hop and all the, all, you know, stuff now. So, and it's, you know, like we said, we call our music feel-good music. You know, I really love when I see the senior citizens come out and they be doing their little rock to it, and they recognize all the songs we play, so it's a good feeling, you know, to see that.
The sound you get is kind of a New Orleans. It reminds me of New Orleans sound, because I guess maybe it's all the horns, all the brass.
Yeah.
You got nine guys in this band. You're on percussion. There's another fella on percussion, and then you got five trombones and a flugelhorn, I believe, correct?
Yes.
How did you decide on what the instrumentation was going to be for this?
Well, we know, being brought up, you know, in the horns, you know, like that, you know, it's the harmony of it, you know, like, as far as singing, you know, have tenor, baritone, you know, bass and all that stuff. So we try to incorporate that together like that.
Now, a lot of kids get interested in things. They get interested in music. They want a pet. They want this. They want that. And then they, after about a week and a half, they lose interest.
Yeah.
These kids have obviously stuck with it.
Yeah.
How long do they practice every day, or do they practice every day?
Yeah, I tell them they should practice at least once a hour. 1 hour every day.
And do they?
Yes, they do. I require it. And then I don't have to tell them anymore. They do it. They practice with different instruments, to learn different instruments. I say you never know how it would help you in life to learn different things and, you know, whatever, you know, so.
Is it hard to teach your children?
No, it's not, because I'm kind of stern. And I just, you know, that's why I tell them to practice. And I teach them a song, and we go over like a few five times, so you should have it by now. So,
wow. Is it all by ear, or are they reading music?
A lot of ear. It's a lot of ear.
Who's this gentleman sitting on your bass
this
drum?
This is my grandson. This is my grandson. They call him Pookie.
Pookie, what do you do with this organization?
Play trombone.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been playing for like 2 years.
2 years? You know, a lot of people who play 2 years aren't good enough to play in front of other people. You guys are. How did that happen?
I really don't know.
Practice. The answer is practice.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Who else we got over here? What's your name?
Kyle Jones.
And you play?
The flugelhorn.
That's right, the flugelhorn. Now, people may not be familiar with what a flugelhorn is. What is it?
It's like a big trumpet, but it's deeper.
And what attracted you to the flugelhorn?
Because they needed somebody to play it for the band, because the other person left.
Do you enjoy it?
Yes.
What do you like about playing out here for all these people?
That they enjoy it.
Because you're not just playing. You're actually entertaining. I mean, you're moving around. You look like you're having a great time. I don't know if you are or not, but it looks like you are, and that's the key to it, isn't it?
Yes.
But you're out here in the heat. You're also, I've seen you guys out here in the cold. Which is worse? Which is harder?
The cold.
Because?
Your mouthpiece gets cold.
The mouthpiece gets cold. I've never thought about that. Of course it does. What do you hope to do with all this music in your life?
Bring it to another level.
And that would be what?
Like playing for the world.
Ha ha! the idea that you guys are out here at night on the streets playing, it gives the whole city a different atmosphere. What kind of reception have you gotten, not only from the people who stream out of these theaters at night and hear you play, but from city officials, from the police, from the mayor, from people like that?
Oh, the police are so supportive of us. I mean, it's unbelievable the love they show. They stop and speak to us. They tease us. All right, now let me get on them drugs, you know, stuff like that. They are wonderful. These Charlotte police are something wonderful. And, you know, and I heard, you know, one of the mayors talking about it's good for the culture of Charlotte. So that makes me feel good too. You know, and they protect us. They watch out for us if they actually any problems. You know. But it's just beautiful, man. It's really unbelievable.
And what do passersby, as they just stumble upon you on the street, have to say, and these theatergoers have to say when they come out in the whole, there's 3,000 people in that theater right now behind us, and when they come out of here, they see you. Some of them have not been to a play here ever before. They must be surprised. What's their reaction?
Oh, this is a wonderful, wonderful reaction. They just stop and, like, you know, I can see the reaction of people's faces, like, what? And then they see the little Mike and the other little guys putting on a little show, and they were like, you know, we try to finish the show, but some of them, they just kind of want to talk and talk.
Bill Jones may be the manager of the Brass Connection, booking the dates and acting as both father and father figure as he encourages these budding musicians to practice individually, but it is Michael Taylor who whips them into collective shape as the leader of the band. What's the secret to making these guys sound as good as they do?
It's practice, but I got to give it all to the man above. He gave us all this talent. And he's leading us in the direction that we're going. So, hey, it all goes, all praises goes to God.
What do you want to happen with this music and with these musicians?
I want something good for us to happen. I want it to happen. That's the only reason I put my time and hard sweat into this, so we can have something good, so we can live better, so my son can grow up and don't have to worry about nothing. So hopefully, if the Lord's will, it'll happen.
In the meantime, though, you're making a lot of people happy out here.
I believe so. I see a lot of people really like us, and I love that. I like for people to enjoy our music. That's a good thing.
You don't just play Charlotte anymore. I'm told that you just returned from Washington, D.C., and yes. You're kind of starting the tour with this group. Where were you in Washington?
We was at DuPont Circle. They showed a lot of love there, too. You know, right now I'm getting calls all this week, and when we're coming back up. And, but I know we had to come back to Charlotte because Charlotte is home.
Is there anything like this? Any other groups like this outside of New Orleans? I mean, do you know of any families? This is like the Jackson 9.
Yeah. That's what people say, hey, Joe Jackson. Yeah, nah. But, you know, they love it.
What do you play?
Trombone.
A lot of trombone players. Do you all compete with each other? Because there are 5 trombone players, if I counted correctly.
No, we don't compete. We just play together.
Play together. And that's hard, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How long do you practice every day?
About like an hour.
Is it something that you want to do? Do you like practicing?
Yeah.
Do you have to be made to practice?
Not really.
Not really. That's what Daddy said, and your grandfather. He said, not really. He's got you well accustomed to having to do what it takes to make it.
The kids love it, you know. I try to teach them responsibility.
A lot of kids today, I think, don't understand that these people that they see on television and hear on the radio, it doesn't just happen. They had to work at it.
They had to work at it. That was better practice. Hard practice, too. Yes, you got to practice. That's the key.
First time that you came out here and played on the street, what was that like?
Scary. I guess it's scary because you don't know how to react.
Did you just decide to do it one day?
Yeah, they said, come on, let's go play downtown. You know.
Now, you're a hit, and they're letting the theater out, so we might as well let you play. You can catch the Brass Connection somewhere on Tryon Street most nights and almost always as the Belcour Night Theaters are letting out for the evening, not only giving the street some life, but some family life. That's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.